Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Raymond Wallander. This is being recorded on Friday, the April the 19th, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Front page headlines, local government and education issues, editorial materials, and following up with miscellaneous articles of local interest. Top headline this morning, the Return to Nature owners plead not guilty, as Zachary DuPont reports. Return to Nature funeral home owners John and Carrie Halford pleaded not guilty Thursday to more than a dozen federal fraud charges stemming from the discovery of nearly 200 bodies decomposing inside a funeral home the couple operated in rural Penrose in Colorado. The 15 federal counts pile atop of 260 criminal charges at the state level, including improper storage of 189 bodies, abuse of a corpse, money laundering, forgery, and theft. The Halfords were arrested in El Paso County on the new federal charges on Sunday, made a brief court appearance Monday that was continued, and appeared in court on Thursday for arraignment and a hearing on detention. Both Halfords pleaded not guilty to all 15 charges, but the bulk of the hearing Thursday, attended by a few loved ones of the deceased, was taken up by the detention hearing, the result of which led to John Halford being detained indefinitely. The Halfords have been out of custody at the state level after each posted a $100,000 surety bond this year. Thursday's detention hearing determined if they would remain in federal custody until their federal case reaches a conclusion. Federal prosecutor Tim Neal, spent nearly an hour arguing to the court that neither Carrie nor John Halford should be given a bond due to the likelihood that they would attempt to flee. Nids pointed out the Halfords' arrest in Oklahoma and the couple's continued alleged attempts to avoid law enforcement in the month leading up to their arrest as proof of a flight risk. Defense attorneys for the Halfords argued that their client's continued success on bond at the state level should show the court that neither presents a flight risk, but Nee disagreed. The stakes have now changed, Nee said, referring to the new federal charges. The Halfords now have a great incentive to take oil. Described the federal charges faced by the Halfords as two wire fraud schemes. The first and most discussed Thursday was the scheme to defraud Return to Nature customers by taking their money for cremation and burial services that did not occur, to the tune of over $100,000, according to NEF. The second was misuse of federal small business loan funds, about $880,000, which was meant to offset the economic pain of the COVID-19 pandemic. But the Halfords used it primarily on personal expenses such as a car, personal vacations, entertainment, dining, a child's tuition, jewelry, and cosmetic medical procedures, among other purchases, according to the federal indictment obtained by the Gazette. NAF stated that the Halfords are facing approximately 7 years in prison if convicted on the 15 wire fraud charges. The Halfords' attorney stated they believe the expected sentence on federal charges won't be as severe as the charges they face at the state level if convicted. NAF spent a considerable amount of time discussing John Halford, specifically claiming that his involvement in the Return to Nature schemes was greater than his wife's, and that he presented a greater flight risk than Carrie Halford. Neff cited one of John Halford's divorce cases in Oklahoma where he failed to appear to divorce proceedings on three occasions, leading to a warrant being issued. Neff also said John Halford still owes over $22,000 in child support to his ex-wife from the divorce. More aggravating factors presented by Neff were new allegations being investigated by Colorado Springs Police and previously reported on by the Gazette that John Holford was engaged in sexual misconduct with a minor. Neff presented text messages to the court allegedly between John Holford and the minor, alleged to be his 17-year-old stepdaughter, in which he makes crude references to her body and asks to kiss and hold her. "I desire to be close to you, and I get closer," Holford wrote in one text message to the alleged victim, according to Neff. "We already have a pretty inappropriate relationship. What if I effing love you so you, yeah, I'd say it's probably safer to never show anything to anyone." A text message from John Holford to his stepdaughter reads, "John Holford's attorney, Laura Suela, objected to the court using the sexual misconduct allegations in the hearing due to the lack of criminal charges faced by her client on the allegations." Suelo said, also disagreed with Neff's representation that Carrie Holford was less involved in misconduct than John Holford, specifically as it relates to the federal case. Suelo claimed that Carrie Holford was in charge of much of the financial side of the Return to Nature business and created many of the fraudulent contracts referred to in the indictment. Ultimately, Magistrate Judge Scott Varholik disagreed with the claims by Suelo and ordered John Holford detained indefinitely pending the conclusion of his federal case and that Carrie Holford be released on a $10,000 conditional bond. Varholik stated that the aggravating factors for John Holford were more significant than those of Carrie Holford and that the differing situations warranted different treatment. John Holford will remain in custody at the Inglewood Federal Correctional Institution just outside Denver, while Carrie Holford will be released to a local halfway house, pending the outcome of an additional bond hearing next Tuesday. Only Carrie Holford will appear at Tuesday's bond hearing, where she should be released from custody if there is space at any local halfway houses. Carrie Holford will remain out of custody on a $100,000 bond in her state-level case and will continue to be monitored by court-ordered GPS tracking. The Holford's next court appearance on local charges is scheduled for July 6th, with a jury trial tentatively set for October. Well, a judge sides against Children's Hospital. A federal judge rejected the hospital's challenge to new Department of Defense rule. And Michael Karlick brings us this story. A federal judge on Wednesday rejected a challenge by Children's Hospital Colorado to a new U.S. Department of Defense rule that will reduce reimbursements to the hospital systems, Colorado Springs and Aurora facilities, by up to $17 million. U.S. District Court Judge Nina Wang determined the department did not exceed its authority under the law, nor did it act arbitrarily in migrating to a new method of paying children's hospitals through TRICARE, the military health care program. With a methodology that now focuses on hospitals' actual costs rather than their historic reimbursements, Wang noted Children's Colorado essentially wanted her to rule the government could never lower its payments to children's facilities. The plaintiff's approach would invalidate any regulation that has the ultimate effect of reducing reimbursements to a recipient hospital that has been repurposing the funds toward any end that could tend to increase care, she wrote in an April 17th order. Lila Roach, senior communications specialist for Children's Colorado, said the organization was particularly concerned about the ruling's effect in Colorado Springs, where its facility serves a high percentage of military children and is the primary pediatric hospital for the region. "Since these TRICARE cuts were finalized last spring, we have been doing and will continue to do everything in our power to advocate with members of Congress and other elected officials about the dangerous consequences of this change and the implications for maintaining access to pediatric specialty care and preserving military readiness," Roche said. The disputed Defense Department rule took effect in October and governs the reimbursements the government pays children's hospitals through TRICARE. With a half dozen military installations in Colorado, the Colorado Springs and Aurora Children's Hospitals serve around 16,500 patients annually who are insured through TRICARE. Children's Colorado, whose total operating revenue is $1.8 billion, estimated its two facilities will lose between $11 million and $17 million in TRICARE reimbursements each year thanks to the new rule, representing around one-third of all savings to the government. As a result, Children's Colorado claimed it will have to turn away emergency room visitors, shutter its cancer and blood center, and reduce pediatric behavioral health programs, among other changes. Consequently, it asked Wayne to vacate the rule. The government, in turn, pointed out that other children's hospitals across the country will actually see increases in reimbursements. The Defense Department also warned Wayne that Children's Colorado was receiving reimbursements at a far higher rate than other large children's hospitals for certain services. It contended that the reimbursements in excess of cost were used to subsidize things like research, professional education, and community health improvement. The dispute was rooted in a 2001 law Congress passed ordering the Defense Department to issue regulations linking TRICARE payments to Medicare reimbursements to the extent practicable. The department attempted to do so gradually without cutting TRICARE reimbursements to children's hospitals. Instead, children's hospitals received harmless payments to prevent their reimbursements from declining. In 2019, the department proposed a new rule that would more directly reimburse children's hospitals for their actual outpatient cost, rather than continue to link current payments to past reimbursements. The rule also authorizes supplemental payments for certain hospitals beyond cost alone. There's nothing in the statute that suggests Congress meant to lock in those reimbursement rates, Alexander Razor with the U.S. Department of Justice told Wang at a hearing last month. The hold harmless requirement is permanent, countered Stacy Carpenter, the lawyer for Children's Colorado. It says, children's hospitals were not going to allow you to have a change in your payment amount because you are this specially designated caregiver. Wang was ultimately unconvinced that federal law required the Defense Department to sustain additional services indirectly funded by its reimbursements to Children's Colorado. While the court recognizes the benefits provided by the additional services allegedly jeopardized by the 2023 final rule, it is not the court's role to determine whether to continue indirectly funding them, she wrote. Roche, the spokesperson for Children's Colorado, clarified the organization is still evaluating the long-term effects of lower reimbursements, but it will not turn away emergency room patients in violation of federal law. Instead, she said the hospitals may have to arrange transportation for some patients to other venues' care. Next up, some good news. An Air Force Academy Visitor Center, Hotel, and Innovation Building are nearing completion, as Mary Shin reports. Rising outside the Air Force Academy's North Gate, wrapped in a waterproof membrane and aluminum skin, the new Hosmer Visitor Center is expected to be finished in May. Then, work will begin to fill the space with exhibits to help visitors understand cadet life and training, such as piloting gliders and running the intense obstacle course in basic training, said Lisa Niener, visitor experience and STEM outreach chief for the Academy. The exhibits we have planned for this space are going to be awe-inspiring, she said. Visitors will enter the new building through a wide oval meant to evoke the tailpipe of a jet and walk through a building meant to symbolize a wing in flight. At its southern end, the building opens up into a grand atrium 110 feet high with stunning views on clear days, officials said. The unusual design and shape of the building, including odd angles, was a challenge in construction, and the contractor worked through 7 months of discussions focused on how to turn the designs into a building, said Kendall Dietzis, a project manager for GE Johnson. The building will replace a visitor center from the 1980s and is expected to open to the public in December 2025. The project faced delays in its financing because the bond market collapsed in March of 2020. The construction got underway in 2022. Once open, Nina expects that center will drive a significant jump in visitation from about 400,000 a year to about 1 million. The boost will achieve one of the main goals of the state financing the project received as part of the City for Champions project, increasing tourism and sales tax generation. The building is the last City for Champions project to go up. The state also provided financing for the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Museum, the Hibble Sports Medicine and Performance Center, Ed Robson Arena, and Widener Field. Hotel Polaris is to open in November. The new visitor center is a key portion of a much larger 57-acre project that also features the 375-room Hotel Polaris across the road. The 9-story hotel, expected to open in November, will be the city's second largest after the Broadmoor. It will offer a full-service spa, conference space, jet flight simulators, and 6 dining options open to the public, including a 1950s-style soda shop, said Curtis Bova, the hotel's general manager, with Greenwood Village-based Coral Tree Hospitality. The building's owners, Provident Resources Group, a Louisiana nonprofit, is expected to transfer the building to the Air Force Academy Foundation once the bonds are paid off in about 15 years, said Mark Hill, CEO of the foundation and the Association of Graduates. Once the transfer happens, the hotel will generate tens of millions for the foundation and projects that provide an excellent experience at the school, such as the school's new Madera Cyber Innovation Center. While West Point has a similar nearby hotel to serve, it is owned by a private company and does not generate revenue to directly benefit the school, Ellis said. Meanwhile, the Innovation Center aims for a 2025 completion. On the Academy's campus, the new $58 million Cyber Innovation Center is also taking shape with a large new concrete spiral staircase running through the 49,000-square-foot building of labs and classrooms. James Mayer, deputy department head of the Department of Computer and Cyber Science, said every freshman will pass through the building for a class focused on artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and big data concerns. The building will also have a secure area where cadets will have a chance to observe real Air Force challenges with hacking and artificial intelligence. Mayer expects it will look like a realistic war room, and cadets will have access to data from real-world conflicts that they can reenact, he said. It will give them that experience of fighting in real wars, he said. Right now, the Academy does not have a large enough secure area for those kinds of projects, he said. Cadets will also use the facility for drone research, allowing them to fly them more consistently no matter the weather. The testing is focused on autonomous systems research and swarming, which allows the drones to work in coordination with each other and ground units, he said. The building will also house Air Force CyberWorks, an innovation lab focused on rapidly prototyping new solutions for service members. We have 4 different focus areas that we are interested in, that being cyber, innovation, operations, optimization, and emerging technology. This facilitates all those different areas, said Colonel Bert Giovanetti, director of CyberWorks. Well, the state approves tax incentives as Project Lightspeed could bring jobs to El Paso County. Bernadette Bertachowski brings us the story. Project Lightspeed could be zooming into El Paso County with the promise of more than 100 jobs. The Colorado Economic Development Commission on Thursday approved $1 million in job growth incentive tax credits over 8 years for Project Lightspeed, the code name for a company that designs and manufactures communications technology. Its clients include the military and NATO. The company, according to information from the commission, recently partnered with an international company using and manufacturing LiFi, that's Light Fidelity Communication, an alternative to Wi-Fi, using light to transmit information. Project Lightspeed represents an effort to start a manufacturing facility in the United States to manufacture this technology and develop a support structure of customer service, engineering, and sales, the commission said. In addition to El Paso County, the company is considering Cheyenne, Wyoming, Tampa, Florida, and Virginia. If company officials decide on El Paso County, it is expected to create 120 jobs with an average wage of $68,108. That's just above the average annual wage in the county. The jobs would include sales, engineers, and warehouse roles. The Colorado Economic Development Commission on Thursday also approved $3.3 million in tax incentives over 8 years for an unidentified Danish company called Project Saffron. The company supplying materials and parts for wind turbine blades wants to build a manufacturing site in Larimer County to be closer to one of its top clients based in Colorado, which also was not named. It's also considering expanding in Wyoming and South Carolina, according to the commission. The wind turbine manufacturing facility is expected to add 210 jobs in the state, with an average wage of $78,230. The company would hire for managers, engineers, technicians, human resource workers, and administration roles. A company representative attended the EDC meeting over Zoom, thanking the organization for approving its tax credits and saying, "Company officials look forward to making the project happen. Our expansion to the United States is of strategic importance to our company," he said. "We have assessed a number of states and locations, and we find Colorado attractive." Then they also approved $1 million over 5 years for Project 11, a sodium-ion battery producer looking at building a research and development campus in Commerce City. The company is also considering Michigan, Kentucky, and California. That campus is expected to add 162 jobs with an average annual wage of $120,000. The company asked for tax incentives through the strategic fund rather than the typical job growth fund because it's an early startup that won't be profitable until 2027 or 2028, said a company representative named Landon at the meeting. The company could potentially be Peak Energy, a Denver-based startup founded in 2023, specializing in sodium-ion energy storage. Its CEO, Landon Mossberg, a former executive at Tesla and Northvolt. "The company's goal is to scale up and manufacture," the company representative told commissioners. "Manufacturing starts for pilot projects. We have 4 customers lined up for that next year. And then we start mass manufacturing in 26. The project could be a big boon for Colorado's supply chain, as Asian companies dominate in sodium-ion battery production, according to the commission. Meanwhile, back at the Air Force Academy, keep your fingers crossed is the headline, as the east side renovation at Falcon Stadium is expected to be finished by late summer, Brent Brigham tells us. The long moon look of Falcon Stadium is officially gone. Local media toured the under-construction home of Air Force football on Thursday morning, catching the first glimpse of its transformed appearance and receiving a briefing on some of the changes that the $90 million project will bring. "We're getting to the point where it's a lot of fun to walk people through here, show off the progress that's been done since last April when we started construction," Athletic Director Nathan Pine said. "There will now be 24 security and ticketing lanes to enter the east side, an increase from 6. There will also be 4 times the restroom and concession capacity on the east side, and with a large kitchen added, there will be enhanced menu options. New lights will better illuminate the action and allow for programmable displays to show key moments. A year-round team shop will also be located on the east side when finished. The enclosed club on the east side will alter the acoustics of the stadium, trapping more sound and, in theory, adding to a home field advantage. Of course, it's that club on the east side that is the most noticeable piece of the project that has distinctly changed the look of the stadium with its enclosed facade that rises up and, when viewed from that area, soon to be encased by glass, provides the impression of hovering over the stadium. They will be arguably the closest club seats in the country. Senior Associate Athletic Director for External Operations, Matt McGahey, said. There will be 850 indoor seats, some of which will be reclining, that provide access to the club, which features a large open concept lobby reached by double elevators, a grand stairway, or what is believed to be the first escalators to be included on an Air Force facility on U.S. soil. An additional 350 covered chairback seats will be located under the overhang of the club's roof. Standing in the open concept club, the central feature of the level that runs roughly end zone to end zone brings to life the scope of the room. The hope for Air Force is to utilize the space for wedding receptions, reunions, and corporate events, generating revenue for around 300 days per year. You don't really understand until you can stand in this space, Pine said of the room, which features floor-to-ceiling windows on the east side facing Colorado Springs and will overlook the stadium and mountains to the west. Access to the club for football games will be contingent upon having tickets to the 850 seats. Single-game availability for the enclosed seats will depend on inventory after season ticket sales are completed. The club also includes an outdoor but covered party deck and an area to host recruits. The kitchen, located under the club's south side, will allow for food to be made on site for the games and other functions in the space. The structure has taken shape, but no finishing touches have been applied. The hope remains to have it open and functioning when Merrimack visits on August 31st for the opening of the 2024 season. The construction crew from GE Johnson has 200 workers putting a combined 8,000 hours per week into the project with that date in mind. Nothing's guaranteed in construction, Pine said, but in our conversations with GE Johnson Nations Group, we feel very good about making it for opening day here at the end of August. Just keep your fingers crossed, they added. A Colorado marijuana bust has Florida ties, as Abby Sukup reports. Nearly two dozen individuals are facing charges in an alleged marijuana distribution scheme that spanned multiple Colorado counties and had ties to Florida. The Colorado Bureau of Investigation, along with the 11th Judicial District, announced Thursday that 23 arrest warrants were issued over the alleged plot to manufacture, process, and distribute marijuana across El Paso, Pueblo, and Fremont counties. Officials said the investigation began at the property of one of the suspects in Fremont County, where a shootout erupted that was allegedly related to the robbery at the manufacturing site between members of the drug trafficking organization. According to the announcement, a 57-year-old woman and her 18-month-old child were struck by stray gunfire during the incident. The female survived her injuries, and thankfully the toddler was not harmed, the news release reads. Anel Martinez, 32, his wife, 41-year-old Martha Romero, and 48-year-old Mario Hernandez were the alleged ringleaders of the drug trafficking organization. At the time of the alleged crimes, Martinez and Romero were employees of the U.S. Bureau of Prisons, and Hernandez was an employee of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. The three have been located and are in police custody, CBI states in the release. According to the release, the group allegedly recruited members for the organization in Colorado and Florida to operate the illegal marijuana manufacturing, processing, and distributing operations throughout the three counties. A joint investigation by the CBI and law enforcement in Colorado and Florida led to 9 arrests after the 23 warrants were served, conducted by the Fremont County Sheriff's Office, CBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration Rocky Mountain Division, the Rocky Mountain High Intensity Drug Trafficking Areas Front Range Drug Task Force, the Tax Enforcement Section of the Colorado Department of Revenue, the 11th Judicial District Attorney's Office, the Canyon City Police Department, the Collier County, Florida Sheriff's Office, along with the Miami Police Department and the DEA, HIDTA Group 43 Miami Division in Florida, led to the 23 warrants issued to the suspects and 9 arrests, That's quite a blanket to cover there with all those organizations. In executing search warrants across the involved properties, the CBI said authorities seized 1,150 illicit marijuana plants, approximately 869 pounds of marijuana product, some packaged for distribution, 13 firearms, some stolen, approximately 3.23 grams of methamphetamine, the recovery of stolen heavy equipment, and the recovery of stolen vehicles, stolen trailers, and a stolen UTV. The 23 individuals are believed to have engaged in the marijuana manufacturing operation to then distribute the product out of state, bypassing enacted regulations and tax requirements, according to release. CBI said the 23 suspects are facing numerous felony charges consisting of a pattern of racketeering, conspiracy, possession of marijuana concentrate, marijuana cultivation, filing false tax returns, and tax evasion. The number of indictments achieved as a result of this investigation demonstrates how expansive this organization was, said DEA Rocky Mountain Field Division Acting Special Agent in Charge, David Oleski. In addition, he continues, the evidence in this case also reveals the ever-present correlation between illegal drug trafficking and violence. As a result of the collaborative efforts of regional law enforcement, this organization will no longer pose a threat to the local community. According to the Thursday release, law enforcement is actively working to locate the remaining 14 suspects. Along with Hernandez, Martinez, and Romero, Fernando Herrera, Ricardo Licourt, Ariel Rizzo, Yanase Guevara, Junior Chavez, and Juan Reyes have also been located and are in custody. Well, countdown begins to the Pioneers Museum grand reopening, as Brianna Gent tells us. Tick-tock, the countdown to the grand reopening of the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum is on. Work that began in July to upgrade the downtown museum's aging heating and air conditioning system is nearly complete, officials said in a news release Wednesday. Over the coming weeks, the system will go through testing and commissioning to ensure it functions properly. The $6.2 million capital project inside the 121-year-old building that was formerly the El Paso County Courthouse also included renovation of an existing gallery plus construction of a new exhibition gallery and a new publicly viewable collections processing and exhibit preparation workspace. Once the museum reopens in the main facility, visitors will have access to spaces previously inaccessible to them. It's such an elegant space, and people don't really know what to expect, Director Matt Mayberry said Thursday, surrounded by various artifacts inside the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum's temporary annex. The annex opened last July across the museum's lawn in the Plaza of the Rockies to accommodate and engage visitors during construction. If all goes to plan, Mayberry and his staff hope the main building will reopen this July. No official grand reopening date has been announced. Staff are creating two exhibits that will be ready by the time of the reopening. A third soon will follow, and by the end of the year, there will hopefully be a fourth new exhibit, Mayberry said. The new heating and air conditioning system is crucial to allowing the museum to do its work, he indicated. We can't do all the other things we need to do unless we take care of our collection, he said. A dependable heating and air conditioning system is needed to adequately preserve fragile artifacts like documents and Native American baskets. Extreme fluctuations in temperature can hurt them, officials previously said. The museum's temporary annex at Plaza of the Rockies, 121 South Tejon Street, Suite 100, will close May 1st. Visitors are welcome until then on Tuesdays through Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Admission is free to visit the three annex exhibits, Black Wings, American Dreams of Flight, Ute Knowledge, Colorado's Original STEM, and Story of Us, Pikes Peak Regional History. For more about the museum and its exhibits, you may visit cspm.org or follow on social media, Facebook and Instagram as @CS Pioneers Museum. Next up, ranchers urge state to lethally manage wolves after attacks. This week's wolf attacks bring the number of calves and yearlings killed by wolves in the past 16 days to 6, plus an injured calf, with news that wolves have killed 4 more yearlings. Marianne Goodland reports. Those wolves have killed 4 more yearling cows in Grand County in less than 72 hours. An association of ranchers is pleading with Governor Jared Polis and Colorado Parks and Wildlife to lethally manage depredating chronically wolves off. 4 yearlings killed by wolves this week were on the same ranch in Grand County. A calf was found injured on a ranch in Jackson County on Saturday, which wildlife officials confirmed. These wolf attacks bring the number of calves and yearlings killed by wolves in the past 16 days to 6, plus the injured calf. The attacks occurred in Grand or Jackson counties. 10 wolves, several that came from packs in Oregon with histories of killing livestock, were released in Colorado in December in Grand County. The wolf attacks began during calving season, which generally runs from March to May or June. Wolf maps from CPW show the animals, which are collared, have been moved as far west as Rio Blanco and Moffitt counties and as far east as Clear Creek and Larimer counties. A collared wolf sent out a ping, which identifies a more precise location at Snow Mountain Ranch this month. The ranch is a popular resort owned by the YMCA of the Rockies that, at this time of year, hosts Nordic skiing, snowshoeing, tubing, and other winter activities. The ranch attracts thousands of visitors, including kids, on its 5,100 acres. The letter from the Middle Park stock growers was sent to the governor, members of the Parks and Wildlife Commission, and Department of Natural Resources Executive Director Dan Gibbs. There have been 5 confirmed depredations in Grand County, but our producers now are more familiar with signs of wolf depredations. We believe they have experienced multiple additional attacks and kills, the group said. The group officially requested to the Colorado Park and Wildlife and U.S. Fish and Wildlife to lethally remove these 2 chronically depredating wolves. CPW has been slow to act on issuing a rule that would define chronic depredation, despite multiple requests from livestock growers and other ranchers who have lost multiple animals to wolves. A definition would allow CPW and ranchers to lethally deal with the wolf problem, ranchers and others said. CPW's response has been to put a plan in place to hire range riders, but that would require covering 1,800 square miles in Grand County and about 70 ranches. The agency has also suggested non-lethal methods of scaring off wolves, which ranchers have said don't work. In their letter, the Middle Park stock growers noted that CPW has admitted the wolves brought to Colorado from Oregon came from known packs with a history of killing livestock. This was a clear violation of the wolf management plan adopted by the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission, the group said. The Middle Park stock growers offered compliments to their local wildlife contacts, but the group also signaled to CPW that its refusal to take action could cost the agency down the road. The Yuma County Cattlemen's Association has said its members will close their gates to wildlife staff who have worked with ranchers in the past on conservation efforts. Landowners play a significant role in the state's conservation work. Indeed, the state's private land program says, without that support, modern-day Colorado's remarkable wildlife abundance and equally rich hunting and fishing opportunities simply would not exist. During an April 5th meeting, Commissioner Marie Haskett of Meeker noted that depredation has begun, but I would like to ask people not to blame CPW for the wolf depredations. What we did was mandated by law, she said, adding that the wolf introduction was the people's will. Aaron Carney, Executive Vice President for the Colorado Cattlemen's Association, isn't buying that argument. Carney said the state agency decided which wolves would be brought to Colorado including animals that came from packs with a history of killing livestock. As an agency, officials must take responsibility for releasing those wolves. A new Colorado law adjusts funding for school districts, as a Senate bill will reallocate $660 million for school districts. Eric Young tells us, a law recently signed by Governor Jared Polis and drafted in part by Lewis Palmer School District 38 representatives will shake up public school funding without changing the dollars. Rather, Senate Bill 24017 changes the distribution schedule of a district's funding throughout the budget year. The new law looks to reallocate $660 million in existing funds for school districts to use as needed. Previously, each school district received 12 equal payments throughout the year, predominantly through funding by the state and local property taxes, with state funding for getting received in the months of March, May, and June. D38 Chief Business Officer Brett Rigway, who helped craft the bill's language, explained this had resulted in dips in cash flow throughout the year for districts like his, who received the majority of their money through the taxes. In previous years, this had led to the district reserving funds to manage gaps in cash flow throughout the budget year. And that became an opportunity for us to say, how can we access those funds so that we don't have to sit on it year in and year out, Ridgway said. And so those two priorities kind of came together really well, and this then solution presented itself, and then we started pursuing conversations. These conversations involved bill sponsors, including State Senator Paul Lundeen, Republican from Monument, the Colorado Department of Education, State Treasurer, and fiscal advisors to the governor. Under the new law, monthly payments will now factor in the local tax estimates and projections throughout the entire year. In the case of D38, $8 million in one-time dollars will now be freed up for the district to access by July 1, the start of the new budget year. A recent projection with the bill, before the bill's passage, showed monthly funding increasing by over $1 million for the current year. Across El Paso County, $146 million will become accessible to school districts in the area. With 881,464 students tallied last fall and the new accessible funding average around $800 per student, D38 Board of Education Treasurer Ron Schwartz said this will allow rural and urban school districts to better use existing funding. It is super rare, if ever, that that kind of capital becomes available without taxpayers paying for it in some form or fashion, he said. For D38, Schwartz explained that the new available funding could potentially help the district focus future spending on career and technical education programs and offerings, while other districts could use their funds to address individual, infrastructure, or salary needs unique to them. Schwartz also noted that the bill, which was passed by the House and Senate almost unanimously, served as a rare example of bipartisanship offering a solution to all parties using existing funds. Not only was this a common sense thing to do, it's something we could do that we should do, so let's do it, he said. And that's the power of depoliticizing the legislature. Turning to the editorial page, today's editorial is entitled Don't Celebrate Colorado's Pot Predators. The pot propagators of today can't seem to agree on the origin of the annual 420 observance that is coming up Saturday. The backstory has various versions, and the marijuana muddled minds that thought it up in the first place probably don't remember. Whatever the dubious date is supposed to signify, permit us to rain on the parade. 420 silly celebration of all things. Cannabis is too often accompanied by unwarranted giddiness in news coverage. There typically also are obligatory and oblivious political pronouncements from Colorado's elected officials about the tax revenue retail pot sales have brought a state and local government since legalization in 2012. and the Pauls, that's P-O-L-S, are sure, that's politicians, are sure to add solemn assurances about the supposedly rigorous regulations governing marijuana commerce, all of which ignores the very real damage legalization has done to our state, and especially to our youth. It is undermining physical and mental health, job readiness, safety on our roads, education, and public safety, among other aspects of everyday life. The organization Smart Approaches to Marijuana, whose mission is to rein in retail pot with hard science and effective regulations, serves as a resource to parents and policymakers alike in navigating the pervasive presence of legal marijuana. This week, Smart Approaches to Marijuana reached out to the media and public to put a damper on 420 enthusiasm by serving up a dose of reality. The national group announced it would be available to the media to fill in the gaps in the propaganda churned out by the marijuana industry. Kudos to the organization. Colorado's media would do well to tap into the group for the other side of the story. Smart Approaches to Marijuana has a wealth of sobering information to share. Colorado-based Executive Vice President Luke Nefaratis will detail how misinformation continues to be pushed by the industry and advocates like Normal, N-O-R-M-L, and Drug Policy Alliance, which flies in the face of science and data, the announcement promises. Marijuana products are getting more potent as the drugs become legal, industrialized, and commercialized, Smart Approaches to Marijuana warns in its statement. These drugs are increasingly linked with a range of health consequences, including IQ loss, depression, suicide, psychosis, stroke, and schizophrenia. It's particularly the peril to Colorado's kids that should be of concern. As Nefaratis wrote in a recent commentary for the Gazette, much like Big Tobacco, which happens to now be one of the top investors in the marijuana industry, Big Weed is up to the same tricks, target kids, and hook an entirely new generation of high-potency users. Indeed, he noted, despite claims that the profit-driven marijuana industry would not sell to minors, when past month high school users in Colorado were asked to identify the one source where they usually obtained marijuana, 4.9% said, "I bought it at a marijuana store or center." In Arizona, where recreational marijuana was legalized in 2020, 21% of 12th grade marijuana users who were surveyed said they had bought it from a dispensary within Arizona, Nefaratis reports. Meanwhile, the potency of today's pot, typically consumed in concentrate form using discrete disposable vape devices sold in every pot shop, is magnitudes higher than just a decade ago. The devices are easily concealed in any middle schooler's backpack. With this jet fuel has come a host of new harms. Marijuana addiction rates are now up to 1 in 3, and your chances of developing schizophrenia are fivefold, according to new research. Nefaratis wrote for the Gazette, "Even though the industry lies that it chills you out, this new high-potency weed is causing more anxiety and psychosis than ever before. That's nothing to celebrate. We'll instead applaud Smart Approaches to Marijuana's efforts to alert Colorado parents about pot's perils to their children." Turning to the letters to the editor, the first one is entitled, "City Should Clean Up Camps." Richard Scorman is to be commended for his efforts in forming Richard's Rubbish Roundup, a nonprofit to perform weekly cleanups using volunteers. "I can't wait to participate in some of the cleanups, but how effective will the cleanup efforts be if the city's code enforcement continues its lackluster efforts to move the homeless camps out? Just this last weekend, when I took a bike ride along Monument Creek, north of Garden of the Gods, I observed numerous homeless camps. Several seemed well-established with colorful tarps and even hard-sided walls. I saw at least two with open patios out front and barbecue grills surrounded by chairs. For a minute, I thought a local organization, whose name I won't mention, was hosting a parade of homes for homeless camps. The trash that was being generated was also quite evident. Not only are these camps in violation of city ordinances, but what they discharge into Monument Creek is in violation of the Federal Clean Water Act. You would think the city of Colorado Springs would take more aggressive action in managing pollution to the creek. We need to make this a community effort within the city, with the city taking a more aggressive approach so that the works of volunteers can be more effective and our waterways free of pollution. And that letter came from Alan Goins of Colorado Springs. The next letter is entitled Tighter Borders for Security. I appreciate the distinction John Ware makes between legal and illegal immigrants in his recent letter, in parentheses, nothing positive about illegals on Wednesday. I, too, am a strong advocate for tighter borders, and I agree that it is hard to see anything positive about millions of immigrants here illegally invading our nation. However, a positive impact of allowing illegal immigration immediately came to mind while reading his piece. Undocumented workers do not have legal resources to higher pay. As an example, imagine if today's average slaughterhouse worker made the same wage as the average American factory worker in the auto industry. By how much would beef prices multiply? Threefold, fourfold, more? By that account.
AfterSight presents your low vision resource of the day. Today, we would like to highlight Health Resources Bright Focus. This organization conducts macular degeneration research. Learn more by visiting www.brightfocus.org, calling 1-800-437-2423, or emailing info@brightfocus.org.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. You're listening to AfterSight.